Welcome back, everyone. What a wonderful, wonderful group we have this morning. And it's such a privilege to be sitting here with my dear friend and teacher. And I just would love to welcome you as we continue our journey exploring how we as people of faith can play our part in healing the disorder, trauma, and evil that's arising around us in today's world. We've begun to hear the call from Jesus into oneness, from a transformed consciousness, as we've been studying the Wisdom Jesus book. This series of teachings has been called into being at this particular time of unrest and confusion in our country and our world. How can we understand the nature of evil? And how can we stand in the face of evil without being destroyed or seduced? Our dear friend and teacher, Cynthia Bourgeot, has midwifed these teaching so beautifully as an offering to assist us in navigating this treacherous and toxic landscape. Let's welcome Cynthia with our beautiful blessing from the late Tom Heck, and we're going to all raise our hands and welcome her.
We bless you as you share your gifts of spirit, light, and insight. We welcome you with joy.
Welcome, Cynthia. What a joy it is to have you and to be able to be sitting here with you back in California.
Yeah.
So what we're going to do today is a little bit different than our typical series. Cynthia has asked that I bring up some questions that have arisen from our community, our group, and perhaps some of you will resonate with these questions as well. So I'm just going to sort of ask the questions and we'll kind of dialogue, and then we'll have an opportunity at the end to ask further questions that come up. But we have been here at the Mercy Center here in Burlingame, California for a week, diving very deeply into this topic. So we are ready to share. Okay, so our first question, Cynthia, could you speak to the urgency of addressing the rise of evil at this time in our world and nature?
Well, yeah, but we need to start by noticing that question itself embedded within it is a foregone conclusion. That what we actually see in the world is the rise of disorder, of chaos, of polarization, of trauma. This is what we can see. These are objective markers. When we call that evil, we're making an evaluative judgment. And this is part of the problem, because when people make this judgment, it's like everybody thinks they know what it is. And the one thing that you can say is that it's going to create a stampede effect, that everybody is going to go with what their own reaction is to evil. And it's like, very bad. And at that point, we stop being able to look at it in an organized and, if one say, processed way. We lose the capacity to address it, because what we've done by labeling it evil the beginning is we haven't addressed it. We've demonized it. And that means that our actions are going to be reactions. So part of the work that I've been doing, there is clearly urgency to speak to the increasing disorder in the culture, but part of the disorder is the fear and panic that it's touching off with people as soon as the evil word gets raised. You know, some people think of boogeymen, some people who are fundamentalist in background go into the devil, some people go into, psychic forces and energy people go into dark forces, and you know, everybody's just going like this. And as the energy field gets more and more disturbed, we're gonna see that actually what happens is that we have a matrix for something that we can not just judgmentally, but qualifiedly, you know, and objectively say, oh, we can call that evil. But you can't skip the steps or you're just going to get reaction. So a lot of what we were doing in this workshop this week was to see if we could break it down into sort of component parts and component steps and see it within a relational field, so that rather than just reacting to the emotional overtones of a word, we could begin to see, okay, well, if there is a process in which it emerges, could you go backwards through that same process to defuse it? And the goal of our response to evil is not to react to it. If we're called to stand with our planet at all, to do what we can to reduce the terror, reduce the enthrallment, reduce the fascination, the agitation, and to see if we can stand present to some higher level of consciousness and calm. If we're going to do that, we need to be orderly and detached and comprehensive in our mode of approach, not only in the way we think, but the way we learn to present our body. So that was some of the work we were working with.
Okay, thank you, thank you. So our next question, wow, a big one. Mm-hmm. Could you explain the nature of evil? And how does evil exist in this field of relationship?
Yeah, well, that was some of the things, explaining the nature of evil. When you asked me to do that, Marianne, you've just gone back and recapitulated 2,500 years of a particular way of looking at things, and a particular conscious framing of the question. And our Western civilization, to be sure, and biblical theology, a lot of it, certainly when you're coming from the prophets on forward, uses the same thing. It's basically a Greek approach, a Greek epistemology, which means a theory of knowledge, how knowledge works. And it says you begin an inquiry by asking what the nature of something is, which is exactly the question you asked me.
You're a good child of your era.
Set you up. And these habits go deep in us. And along with that first question of beginning to tackle a subject by trying to get the big picture, what is its nature? Along with that comes the accompanying question, what is its ontology? And the word ontology is, again, a theological, philosophical word that means what is it, what is the substance it's composed of? So these are questions that belong to a world which thought in clearly defined boundaries, in things having natures and substances in and of themselves. And if you pinpointed what those natures and substances were to begin with, then you could go out and look at what their effect was by identifying other natures and substances. But that mode of thinking, which is very much a child of the middle structure of consciousness, has been essentially discredited and bypassed in our modern world, beginning, of course, in the world of quantum physics, where we begin to get concepts which were so threatening and destabilizing to our usual Western philosophical reference points. Because what people saw was, instead of a world of fixed entities, natures, substances, we saw a world of fluctuating, dynamic, interpenetrating, transient identities working within a relational field. And guess what? We are part of that field. And while Heisenberg's principle has been radically bastardized and applied out of context, which makes scientists pull their hair out, nonetheless, it does have a truth that for the world that works mostly in literature and ideas, a philosophical world, it's an important revolutionary new concept that the observer can't be detached. That the observer is the part of the picture, and the energy that you bring into an observation, your perspective, is going to affect the overall mix of relational field. So for years and years, for centuries and centuries, people have approached the question of evil ontologically. What is the nature of evil? And then, of course, the next question that comes right out of that was, well, did God create evil? And then you get into that great old philosophical dualism. Well, you can't have it both ways. God can't be omniscient and omni-loving at the same time, or omnipotent. If God created evil, God can't be all good, because he knew that evil was going to be hurtful. And if God didn't create evil, but evil was a separate and independent force, then how could God be all powerful? And, you know, theologians have batted that about, and Christian theologians have tried to figure out some way that Christ somehow gets us out of this dualism. But the real problem is the setup of the dualistic nature of the mind opposing these great either ors. So this has had powerful impact on the world. You know, that a lot of the world, particularly of fundamentalist and evangelical roots, is quite certain that there is an opposite force called the devil, and that even though Jesus has theoretically mastered him, that this is still scary. And people that don't like the God language, which is a lot of people coming from much more sort of, you know, secular New Age backgrounds, transpose the whole thing onto a base of energies. And it becomes more convenient to talk about light energies and dark energies, but it's still the same damn thing in a new vestiture that removes the relational language. So what we were trying to do, and it was the big teaching in this during the week of our work together here, was to approach evil not as an original substance or ontology, but as a product of a relational field, that you can't pull apart the threads to find a seed of something that's called evil. That the whole thing emerges, you know, deeply contextually. And I'm using my words carefully, because I'm not trying to say situationally in the way that theologians will immediately say, well, does that mean it doesn't have an absolute value? Once again, this is trying to apply the old way of thinking, new principles. It's like, you know, we know that quarks and electrons and things appear and disappear in life, you know, and they take shape and they diffuse within a relational field. So what happens if we start looking not at the model that begins with separate ontologies, but begins instead with beginning to notice the nature of the field? And then within the field, notice what characteristics are there. And then you can trace the characteristics as they move in and out. It's like tracing the colors of the rainbow in any particular color pattern. So that's the way we were working. And this way of thinking is taking over more and more of the liberal arts sciences too. Many brain scientists, many sort of sociologists, people are thinking in terms of systems theories, more process theories. You just can't take the parts in isolation. You have to put them together, because a field has what are called emergent properties that don't exist in the parts. And you can't see them until they get together. And people actually tear their hair out when they notice that, like, two individuals that on the surface seem perfectly fine and normal and, you know, nice people, you know, they get together and all of a sudden something emerges out of the dynamics of the relationship that is so dangerous and toxic that you don't know where to turn. You just know the whole thing is going like this. And people say, well, who was to blame? Was it this one or was it that one? It was neither. It was a function of something that gets generated in small relationship field. And when you take that field apart, the thing disappears. Which, folks, is going to be the key if we get lost in words. to the practice of remediating that we were working in this. You've got to sort of slowly diffuse the energy. And so you may have noticed during this talk that I've been doing this. We practiced it in a movement, so that's part of why. But the characteristic that everybody can pick up on, whether consciously or unconsciously, is that when you are in the presence of what we call evil, what you're actually picking up first and foremost is a disturbed energy field. And people will, you know, if we start right there, almost everybody can say, you know, something's not smooth in the atmosphere, something's jangled. And very often it has the feeling of being this kind of constricted presence. And so if we take those markers and then trace them back, we can match them up with some of the classic definitions of evil and find a way that we can at least bring them into dialogue. So we started in our teaching this week with an oldie but goodie by Scott Peck called People of the Lie, which was in some ways a brave and in some ways a downright embarrassing book, trying to trace the origins of evil and to trace it. He was a psychiatrist, and he was trying to create a relationship between evil and trying to get it named as essentially as a personality disorder. This was in the era before they had actually identified personality disorders, but evil is a kind of pathology. And some of his methodology was, you know, so primitive. It was like operating on the brain with a fork and a knife. but yet he was asking some very interesting questions, and it was the first time to try and knock it off its base of complete ownership by philosophical models. Rather than asking what is its nature, he was beginning to ask, how does it work? And where does it first touch base? Where does it grow legs in the human condition? And those were the right questions, although he was asking them clumsily. Mm-hmm. So his definition of evil was something to the effect, I don't have the book right in front of me anymore, but it was a force coming either from inside or outside the person that led to the diminishment of life or liveliness in another. In other words, it's a harmful force that can either end your physical life or sort of just deplete you and destroy you emotionally, spiritually. So that was his definition. And we spun all that off of this. And I had, before I came to this retreat, I had had my own sort of working revision of that, which was clunkier. I mean, it would never have passed the English poetry contest. But Scott Peck won by a mile, but it was perhaps more effective in terms of actually being able to look at the steps and preventing innocent blood from being shed. So we fine-tuned it at the workshop, and these things are always interactive dialogues. You know, the teacher comes with what they think they're teaching, and then they get taught by the students.
Right.
So we collectively worked at this as a definition. I think I can still sort of reconstruct it. Evil is a toxically disturbed and contagious energy field activated in individuals, in an individual or individuals, through the enactment of a habitually imprinted willful urge to destroy or harm others in the effort to preserve one's own ego or self-structure. So that's a mouthful of words, and I'm going to go back. We discovered as we looked at it, and I put numbers after each of these points, that it was actually a sevenfold map, and that each of these seven picks up a really important point where if you don't get it right on the money, you're going to wind up hurting somebody. So I started out by saying it's a toxically disturbed and contagious energy field. I located evil in the field to begin with, rather than in the individual components that might make it up. And trying to pick out the qualities that it's disturbed. It's this you know, it's this, you know, this what we've been talking about, the body knows how to do it, disturbed and contagious. Because this is one of the fascinating and horrifying things about evil, is that it spreads even faster than the coronavirus when you get the right seedbed. And it has the nature of wishing to jump to that way. So that's the first, a toxically disturbed and contagious energy field activated in individuals or group, and an individual or individuals. And I use the word activated rather than created. You know, that because for this specific occasion, you could say it's created. But as we looked at it in the retreat, with the long map of the traditional chain of being maps of the world, we see that this strain, this motion that leads to this, has a long, long history in the cosmogonic processes, not only of this world, but of worlds far beyond us. So it's not so much that we create it anew, but that we join a current that's already out there and flowing. And that's what gives it such a quickly reinforcing thing. Once we activate it here, it quickly gains reinforcements from a cosmological history that maybe goes back 14 billion years in this planet and quickly into dimensions from beyond time. And I know your group hasn't really worked with either Gurdjieff or the Great Chain of Being maps, but it's a really important place to get the long range perspective. So work for next year. Anyway, I said activated individual or individuals, because it does come in both varieties. Sometimes an individual will walk into a situation who has already kind of grabbed the characteristic set of defenses as a stable enough default response to things that you could say that this person would fit the bill of what we would kind of classically and typically think of as an evil person. And that has come, again, not by anything in their nature, but by the repeated laying down of neural tracks, by the repeated action. So that evil is a toxically divided, disturbed and contagious energy field activated by individual or individuals through the enactment. And I made that really, really clear. Scott Peck doesn't make that clear. That whatever we may think, every single one of us in the room, I dare say, has wished at some point that you could strangle somebody. You know, you get so damn mad at somebody, you kill him, get him away from me, I never go. You know, we all harbor this inner murderer, you know, and we've all known periods where in our rage and our despair and our undealt with trauma and shame, we get so angry that we could just take people apart brick by brick. But the distinction is that we don't act out of it, most of us. We have enough self-control. And you notice you have to have a self to have self-control. We have enough self-control that we can step back from that. And even though it's painful and you feel like you're being destroyed by not being able to release this energy of rage that you're feeling, that nonetheless you say, the consequences aren't going to look pretty, and you don't do it. So, you know, I think that Jesus actually gave people a sort of wrong cue when he said that, you know, I tell you that even, even if you lust for the woman in your heart, you know, that you've committed evil. I mean, he's setting it to a high benchmark, which has made it really, really hard for people to own those murderous impulses that we have. You know, the tendency is to repress them because you know that this is so unacceptable that even Jesus said it's unacceptable to have these ideas. I can't have them there. Down goes the dissociative lid. And the moment that clacks down, you know, that evil has got an airtight anaerobic environment to start to matriculate in, you know? So we have to keep it out in the open. And by acknowledging that we all have these impulses, but we don't, you know, just to have them doesn't mean that we're under the compulsion to act on them. So evil for me begins in an enactment. You know, the people sitting there punching their pillows in rage, you know, are not evil, okay? But to go on, the enactment of a habitually imprinted willful urge. Now, I'm trying to talk there with a couple of words about, to get around a couple of issues. When I use the word willful, it deals with the question people say, is evil conscious or unconscious? And this comes up in courts of law a lot of times. You know, was the person who's on the stand, was this person conscious of their deed? Was it, you know? But what we discover again in a lot of psychology is that a lot of action can be willful without being conscious. And one of the things that Scott Peck's book does so beautifully is it gives us case studies of people who on the surface seem to have no conscious realization that they seem to have some program to hurt somebody. And so they're so genuinely shocked by that, that they deny it immediately when they're called on. And yet the repeated actions certainly say, well, you know, if you don't have harmful intentions to this person, why are you acting towards this person in this way? And why is this person responding in a classic pattern of being wounded? So sometimes, you know, I think it was Freud who first raised us to the horrible recognition that we act out of things that we can't own yet consciously. So that's why I use the word willful. It means it's maybe not conscious, but nor is it accidental. It's not a crime of passion when suddenly, you know, you just get overwhelmed by something and plunge the dagger into the person and then spend the rest of your life in prison in remorse because you didn't know what happened in that moment. So, and habitual is the other thing. And I think that I can, habitual imprint, that I think I can speak in alignment with science, cognitive science, and also in alliance with, you know, the whole Gurdjieffian tradition, that it's the laying down of the neurological tracks that gradually build this as the default action. The same with any kind of addiction, you know, the same with any kind of false self-defensive behavior. At first, you just try it out. And there's still a little bit of freedom to move back from it. But at some point, you've so sort of laid down as that's the default track that you operate in. So a person that will habitually and by default meet any criticism by denial and blaming, you know, everybody does it occasionally. But if that becomes the standard place to the point where you can't even hear criticism, then you have habitually laid down a pattern in you that it's going to be very, very difficult to bring consciousness to under stress. And this is the problem, that the ante gets radically upped under stress. And when you perceive yourself under stress, that ability to stand back and say, no, I will not react that way, goes out the window. And the more you've laid down default neural patterns that lock you into a course of action, the more you're just going to go down the primrose path of where those neurons send you. So that's that part that if you even want to use the language, people become evil, the route toward that would be through the long selecting over a period of time of this particular response, which creates damage in others. So it's not that you instantly wake up like in the cowboy dramas you saw as a child, and the guy who rides in with the black horse and the black pony is, with the black hat is, oh, evil, you know. We like to think that people are born on the planet evil, like the purple M&Ms or something. It doesn't work that way, you know. It's a habitual pattern. These things exist in time. Time sculpts evil. Time sculpts goodness. Then the final bit of it, the habitually imprinted willful urge to destroy or harm others. Okay, I think we could probably pass over that. We know what that one means. And then the last one, in order to preserve one's own ego or self-structure. And this is really important because some people harm others for what you might call innocent and pure motives. You know, I still tremble for a fellow I met when I was teaching remedial writing in the state prison system in Maine. He was in for life, and I asked why. He says, well, I murdered my father with my bare hands. And I said, why? And he says, well, I came home and found him raping my 13-year-old sister. So if the evil was committed in the act of taking the life of this monster, that it was not done by the perpetrator to enhance his ego structure, it was done out of a justifiable outrage at the atrocity he saw being committed to one he loved, the sister. So the thing that gives the fragrance of ego its particular fragrance is this sense of the sucking to himself, where we're destroying another in order to take the power that person had unto ourselves, in order, in some sense, to enhance our own sense of enlivenment, structure, existence, power. And while that is intensely talked about in Christian tradition and all traditions as ego and sin and immediately taken to selfishness, I think that contemporary psychology, and particularly psychology that has emerged in the fields of working compassionately with certain sort of psychiatric disorders, including not only the cluster B, the narcissistic borderline, but also in schizophrenia and some of the others, we begin to realize that the self-structure is a terribly fragile thing, and that to hold yourself together is a work of art and will. And even people who are just terminally wounded and fragile, the amount of effort it takes to draw things from the world, not as a matter of being mean and triumphing and, you know, it's not that. It's a matter of hanging on for dear life. If I don't get something that affirms me and gives me enough sense of the center of me to live, I go and scatter off like a million pieces into the cosmos. So it's with great compassion. I mean, I think we got to get rid of these images that look at polished devils. And and realize that people are, in the majority of cases, just grasping something they need. And the irony of this whole thing is once they grasp it, it can give them that quick fix. You know, it's like Red Bull for ego, you know, that all of a sudden you come back together and there's enough in trolley. When you've wounded another, when you've sucked their blood, when they cower before you, when they lay in bits and pieces on the floor, and you have a sense of, okay, I exist. That has to be held with tremendous compassion at the same time you see what has happened. At the same time. So this is a long sort of taking you through the heart of what we did in this workshop. But it's really to talk about when you see these elements gradually and incrementally building over time in a relationship, essentially the presence of any of these factors. Adding a couple more that I can't really talk about, that around this rises a swirl of confusion that we like to call deception, but it begins just as confusion. It's like there's this kind of cognitive dissonance. The pictures aren't matching up. This looks okay on the surface, and what, yet it smells bad, and you know, and so all this kind of swirl of confusion, you don't know where to put in your sword, is the matrix in which it forms. And because we can look at it relationally, and because we can construct it within a relational field, the wager is that we can also deconstruct it within a relational field. And therein lies the hope, if we have the courage to wield it.
Okay. So, which kind of brings us to the next question. We were very fortunate to have Rebecca Parker with us a couple of weeks ago talking about the Gebser model of the structures of consciousness. So I'm going to ask you to explain the relationship between this declining mental structure and the relationship with evil.
Okay. So yeah, one of the things that Gebser's map lets us do is it lets us tell us when evil entered the field of consciousness. We can say using Gebser's map of the structures of consciousness, that the whole question of the nature of good and evil did not arise as a philosophical question until the beginning of the middle structure of consciousness. That before, in the mythic structure of consciousness, good and evil are felt as a polarity, like in the yin and yang symbol. The one is in the other and flows into the other in repetition and cycle. In the magic consciousness, there's just mana, power. And you disappear into it and you emerge out of it and you exchange places within it. There's not a stable self structure that mediates it. In the middle structure of consciousness, as it first began to arise around the world in the period of about 800 to 200 BC, we begin to organize the structure of consciousness in a whole different way, with a center of perception, which we call I, and a subject-object relationship with the world out there. And it leads to a habit of thinking that allows for the what were the great polarities of the mythic structure to become the great dialectics of the middle structure of consciousness. And when Richard Rohr and others keep beating up on you of dualistic thinking is the operating system that comes already installed in the middle structure of consciousness. It will automatically pivot to setting things up as polar opposites, and then exploring, weighing, comparing, evaluating. So we can see that questions about what is evil, what is the source of evil, the awareness of evil as a formed, configured force with a nature, are questions that begin to arise in that early middle structure of consciousness. And so dialogues and our investigations of evil to this day are still sort of framed within the structures of the middle structure of consciousness. So Gebser, as Rebecca Crowley reminded you, divides each period as into an early or efficient phase and a deficient phase in which the life goes out of it in a way, and it becomes more automatic and rote and mechanical or baroque, overdone. And this was true in the middle structure of consciousness. And the deficient stage of it, he really places in about the beginning of what in Europe is the Renaissance, with the discovery of perspectival thinking. And perspectival thinking is something that we use all the time in our way of thinking. The term originates in art, where if you want to show on a two-dimensional canvas something that looks like it has three dimensions, you arrange it using laws of perspective. You get a distant point on the horizon, orient everything within a cone of perception within it. And you can only draw the things that lie within that cone of perception, and you can only draw them in a certain way. Like when you're using perspectival thinking, you can't show the front side and the back side of a house simultaneously because they don't exist in the plane. If you look out the window here with your perspectival thinking, you can't see any house, its front side and its back side together. So perspectival thinking set in, which gave us Renaissance painting and all its beauty and art and the Enlightenment. But it's also a thinking which is by its nature sectored, exclusive. You know, you can only sort of put together things in a cone, and then you can only put them together in a certain order. And really geared towards measuring, comparing, not in a healthy, but in a sort of analytic and diagnostic way. The word rational, which we're so proud of, comes from ratio, which means to cut. So it's a cutting edge. And so for us, as we live it, evil becomes more and more perspective and more contained within sectors, more quantitative, more measured, more pathologically diagnostic. And we find that what people hold to be true of evil in one sort of sector, let's call it evangelical Christianity, and what's held in another, let's call it the behavioral sciences, can't talk to each other. And so the tendency is to not be able to have conversations anymore. Radical polarization, you have to pull your cone around you. We call them a silo nowadays, because you can only talk to people that are in your cone. And what has happened is that in this, the question of evil, which got spawned as a philosophical premise in the middle structure of consciousness, now gets captured in the trash compactor. And so this is why we're feeling it as so anguished, I think, right now. Because the good news is we may be, the only way to fall out of this is to fall out of the cone into a new structure of consciousness that we have to mature into. So I think that's probably enough.
Well, because I want to get to the big question.
Okay. What's the big question?
The big question. Well, this week, you made a very provocative statement to the students, and I would really like you to address this.
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't love the answer to confronting evil?
Well, our theology tells us it is, doesn't it? Just throw more love at it, throw more love at it. And I think the answer to this, which is just totally counterintuitive to Christianity, certainly it goes against every vein, is that love doesn't work thrown against evil. And we learn why in the kind of petri dish of some of the personality disorders. And I'm saying this really, really, really carefully because I don't want to draw any sort of causal relationship between these. But there's a certain sector of behavior personality disorders that can be measured that do not respond to what we think is love. And the problem is on two ends. First of all, this is a response that people can't understand. And second, we don't know what love is. Our notions of love are so themselves unclear, fuzzy, and susceptible to emotional manipulation that we don't get a clear picture of what we're supposed to do with love, that it often turns into a kind of clinging or possession or self-importance or drama around, I will never leave you. And evil looks at it at best as weakness. And at worst as positively irritating. And at very worst as like an animal rolling over and showing you its underbelly. Because evil was the seeds of the evil complex in people are almost always sown in shame and trauma. And in somebody having reduced you to powerlessness, that there is, seems to be in evil a natural abhorrence and terror of powerlessness. And at the same time, the other side of that, a repulsion towards it. So a person who comes in preaching kenosis, oh, I'm just going to surrender, I'm just going to die on my little cross for you. Aha! This irritating idiot. And every dagger plunged into the soft underbelly of a person who has naively thought that they could stand up to evil by bringing what their sort of cheerful, hopeful, theologically, Christian, scripturally grounded teaching says is love. It's just stupid suffering. And for many people who are working with escape from abusive relationships in which the element of trauma bonding happens, that this thing of why do people become addicted to their abusers so that they can't break away, it has to do with this syndrome. But that you find over and over and over again, people running back to try and throw one more, if I can only stand present to this person for another 5 months, it'll be okay. You get another 5 months of being sucked out, sucked alive, and intensifying this noxious relational field. Finally, the only thing you can do in love is to step aside. Deeply step aside and say, this is not my battle to fight, that what I can bring to it isn't working, and that something else has to happen. Over and over again in all the fields, what has been discovered by psychiatry, prison wardens, exorcists in the classic mode, is that evil responds only to authority, only to being commanded by a superior force. And in this world, what we call love and what we try and practice as love is not that superior force. It's not because love is ultimately deficient or bankrupt. In worlds beyond our own to which we're created, love is indeed the answer. And that place is being held for us by Jesus on the cross. But in this world, what is needed is a clear being authority that rooted in what I suggested to people in the workshop is the place to begin is not with love, but with conscience.
Mm-hmm. You know, that brings to mind an image that just comes up for me. In 1989, the young man standing in Tiananmen Square in front of the tank, that standing firm in the face
that
of
standing firm, and the fragrance that is emitted from that instantly shifts something.
Yeah.
Instantly. And even if there is your own death involved in it, which it frequently does,
right.
It's like that's the power in one sense of the crucifixion, and I'm always haunted by the story there of when Jesus dies on the cross, and this hardened old centurion is there to guard it so that nobody steals his body and makes it look like he's died. When Judas dies, this guy looks and says, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." How did he come to know that? And he didn't know it a minute before, or he would have let him off the cross. There was something in the fragrance of Jesus's completed being when it left his body and went into the world in this sacrifice of this is love, that that changed the nature of the energy field. And these acts of conscience, witness in conscience, do make an immediate direct bite on the energy field. They shift the mix instantly, almost miraculously. You can think of Bonhoeffer and his friends in the Nazi plots. You can think of so many times, sometimes these witnesses, Eddie Hilsum in the concentration camps, deciding to join her Jewish sisters in Auschwitz. These acts that are done out of a purity of being are the deepest authority to command evil with. But the problem is we're wimps, because that kind of freedom exists on the other side of death. And whether it's physical death or what is always the precursor to it, the willingness, the full willingness to die before you die, not just in the matter of your physical death, but the dying before you die, instant by instant, in the laying down of self, even in the laying down of thoughts in your centering prayer practice, the releasing of that constrictive motion that we saw is so often present in the energy field as this desperate sucking to myself so I exist, that dying, kenosis, is the opposite. It's a releasing of that point. It's the outbreath, the final outbreath that allows the breathing to be complete. And so it's in that way that purity of conscience attained through the sincere willingness and ability to die to self is the agent that in this world is pure enough, strong enough, and undivided, unconflicted enough in its own vibrational field that it can shift the whole. Amen.